You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. Gentlemen and Players. Old Raffles may or may not have been an exceptional criminal, but as a cricketer I dare swear he was unique. Himself a dangerous bat, a brilliant field, and perhaps the very finest slow bowler of his decade, he took incredibly little interest in the game at large. He never went up to Lord's without his cricket-bag, or showed the slightest interest in the results of a match in which he was not himself engaged. Nor was this mere hateful egotism on his part. He professed to have lost all enthusiasm for the game, and to keep it up only from the very lowest motives.
Cricket, said Raffles, like everything else, is good enough sport until you discover a better. As a source of excitement, it isn't in it with other things you've wot of, Bunny, and the involuntary comparison becomes a bore. What's the satisfaction of taking a man's wicket when you want his spoons? Still, if you can bowl a bit, your low cunning won't get rusty, and always looking for the weak spot's just the kind of mental exercise one wants. Yes, perhaps there's some affinity between the two after all. But I'd chuck up cricket tomorrow, Bunny, if it wasn't for the glorious protection it affords a person of my proclivities.
How so? Said I. It brings you before the public, I should have thought, far more than is either safe or wise.
My dear Bunny, that's exactly where you make a mistake. To follow crime with reasonable impunity, you simply must have a parallel, ostensible career. The more public, the better. The principle is obvious. Mr. Peace, of pious memory, disarmed suspicion by acquiring a local reputation for playing the fiddle and taming animals. It's my profound conviction that Jack the Ripper was really an eminent public man, whose speeches were very likely reported alongside his atrocities. Fill the bill in with some prominent part, and you'll never be suspected of doubling it with another of equal prominence. That's why I want you to cultivate journalism, my boy, and sign all you can. And it's the one and only reason why I don't burn my bats for firewood.
Nevertheless, when he did play, there was no keener performer on the field, nor one more anxious to do well for his side. I remember how he went to the nets before the first match of the season, with his pockets full of sovereigns, which he put on the stumps instead of bales. It was a sight to see the professionals bowling like demons for the hard cash, and whenever a stump was hit a pound was tossed to the bowler and another balanced in its stead, while one man took £3 with a ball that spread-eagled the wicket. Raffles' practice cost him either 8 or 9 sovereigns, but he had absolutely first-class bowling all the time, and he made 57 runs next day. It became my pleasure to accompany him to all his matches, to watch every ball he bowled or played or fielded,
and to sit chatting with him in the pavilion when he was doing none of these three things. You might have seen us there, side by side, during the greater part of the gentlemen's first innings against the players, who had lost the toss, on the second Monday in July. We were to be seen, but not heard, for Raffles had failed to score, and was uncommonly cross for a player who cared so little for the game. Merely taciturn with me, he was positively rude to more than one member who wanted to know how it had happened, or who ventured to commiserate with him on his luck. There he sat, with a straw hat tilted over his nose and a cigarette stuck between lips that curled disagreeably at every advance. I was therefore much surprised when a young fellow of the same exquisite type came and squeezed himself in between us, and met with a perfectly civil reception despite the liberty. I did not know the boy by sight, nor did Raffles introduce us, but their conversation proclaimed at once a slightness of acquaintanceship and a license on the lad's part which combined to puzzle me. Mystification reached its height when Raffles was informed that the other's father was anxious to meet him, and he instantly consented to gratify that whim. "He's in the ladies' enclosure. Will you come round now?" "With pleasure," says Raffles. "Keep a place for me, Bunny." And they were gone. "Young Crowley," said some voice further back. "Last year's Harrow 11." "I remember him. Worst man in the team." "Keen cricketer, however. Stopped till he was 20 to get his colours. Governor made him. Keen breed. Oh, pretty, sir, very pretty!" The game was boring me. I only came to see old Raffles perform. Soon I was looking wistfully for his return, and at length I saw him beckoning me from the palings to the right. "Want to introduce you to old Amersteth," he whispered when I joined him. "They've a cricket week next month. When this boy Crowley comes of age, and we've both got to go down and play."
"Both?" I echoed. "But I'm no cricketer."
"Shut up," says Raffles. "Leave that to me. I've been lying for all I'm worth," he added sepulchrally as we reached the bottom of the steps. "I trust you not to give the show away."
There was a gleam in his eye that I knew well enough elsewhere, but was unprepared for in those healthy, sane surroundings. And it was with very definite misgivings and surmises that I followed the Zingari blazer through the vast flower-bed of hats and bonnets that bloomed beneath the lady's awning. Lord Amersteth was a fine-looking man, with a short moustache and a double chin. He received me with much dry courtesy, through which, however, it was not difficult to read a less flattering tale. I was accepted as the inevitable appendage of the invaluable Raffles, with whom I felt deeply incensed as I made my bow.
"I have been bold enough," said Lord Amersteth, "to ask one of the gentlemen of England to come down and play some rustic cricket for us next month. He is kind enough to say that he would have liked nothing better, but for this little fishing expedition of yours, Mr.—"
And Lord Amersteth succeeded in remembering my name. It was, of course, the first I had ever heard of that fishing expedition, but I made haste to say that it could easily, and should certainly, be put off. Raffles gleamed approval through his eyelashes. Lord Amersteth bowed and shrugged.
"You're very good, I'm sure," said he. "But I understand you're a cricketer yourself."
"He was one at school," said Raffles with infamous readiness.
"Not a real cricketer," I was stammering meanwhile.
"In the 11?"
said Lord Amersteth. "I'm afraid not," said I.
"But only just out of it,"
declared Raffles, to my horror.
"Well, well, we can't all play for the gentlemen," said Lord Amersteth slyly. "My son Crowley only just scraped into the 11 at Harrow, and he's going to play. I may even come in myself at a pinch, so you won't be the only duffer, if you are one. And I shall be very glad if you will come down and help us, too. You shall flog a stream before breakfast and after dinner, if you like."
"I should be very proud," I was beginning as the mere prelude to resolute excuses, but the eye of Raffles opened wide upon me, and I hesitated, weakly, to be duly lost.
"Then that's settled," said Lord Amersteth, with the slightest suspicion of grimness. "It's to be a little week, you know, when my son comes of age. We play the Free Foresters, the Dorsetshire Gentlemen, and probably some local lot as well. But Mr. Raffles will tell you all about it, and Crowley shall write. Another wicket! By Jove, they're all out! Then I rely on you both."
And with a little nod, Lord Amersteth rose and sidled to the gangway. Raffles rose also, but I caught the sleeve of his blazer.
"What are you thinking of?" I whispered savagely. "I was nowhere near the 11. I'm no sort of cricketer. I shall have to get out of this."
"Not you," he whispered back. "You needn't play, but come you must. If you wait for me after 6:30, I'll tell you why."
But I could guess the reason, and I am ashamed to say that it revolted me much less than did the notion of making a public fool of myself on a cricket field. My gorge rose at this as it no longer rose at crime, and it was in no tranquil humor that I strolled about the ground while Raffles disappeared in the pavilion. Nor was my annoyance lessened by a little meeting I witnessed between young Crowley and his father, who shrugged as he stopped and stooped to convey some information which made the young man look a little blank. It may have been pure self-consciousness on my part, but I could have sworn that the trouble was their inability to secure the great Raffles without his insignificant friend. Then the bell rang, and I climbed to the top of the pavilion to watch Raffles bowl. No subtleties are lost up there, and if ever a bowler was full of them it was A.J. Raffles on this day, as indeed all the cricket world remembers. One had not to be a cricketer oneself to appreciate his perfect command of pitch and break, his beautifully easy action, which never varied with the varying pace, his great ball on the leg stump, his dropping head ball, in a word, the infinite ingenuity of that versatile attack. It was no mere exhibition of athletic prowess. It was an intellectual treat, and one with a special significance in my eyes. I saw the affinity between the two things, saw it in that afternoon's tireless warfare against the flower of professional cricket. It was not that Raffles took many wickets for few runs. He was too fine a bowler to mind being hit, and time was short, and the wicket good. What I admired, and what I remember, was the combination of resource and cunning, of patience and precision, of headwork and handiwork, which made every over an artistic whole. It was all so characteristic of that other Raffles whom I alone knew.
"I felt like bowling this afternoon," he told me later in the hansom. "With a pitch to help me, I'd have done something big. As it is, 3 for 41, out of the 4 that fell, isn't so bad for a slow bowler on a plum wicket against those fellows. But I felt venomous. Nothing riles me more than being asked about for my cricket as though I were a pro myself."
"Then why on earth go?"
"To punish them. And because we shall be jolly hard up, Bunny, before the season's over."
"Ah," said I, "I thought it was that."
"Of course it was. It seems they're going to have the very devil of a week of it. Balls, dinner parties, swagger, house party, general junketings, and obviously a house full of diamonds as well. Diamonds galore. As a general rule, nothing would induce me to abuse my position as a guest. I've never done it, Bunny. But in this case, we're engaged like the waiters and the band, and by heaven we'll take our toll. Let's have a quiet dinner somewhere and talk it over."
"It seems a rather vulgar sort of theft," I could not help saying. And to this, my single protest, Raffles instantly assented.
"It is a vulgar sort," said he, "but I can't help that. We're getting vulgarly hard up, and there's an end on it. Besides, these people deserve it and can afford it. And don't you run away with the idea that all will be plain sailing. Nothing will be easier than getting some stuff, and nothing harder than avoiding all suspicion, as of course we must. We may come away with no more than a good working plan of the premises. Who knows? In any case, there's weeks of thinking in it for you and me."
But with those weeks I will not weary you further than by remarking that the thinking was done entirely by Raffles, who did not always trouble to communicate his thoughts to me. His reticence, however, was no longer an irritant. I began to accept it as a necessary convention of these little enterprises. And after our last adventure of the kind, more especially after its denouement, My trust in Raffles was much too solid to be shaken by a want of trust in me, which I still believe to have been more the instinct of the criminal than the judgment of the man. It was on Monday the 10th of August that we were due at Milchester Abbey, Dorset, and the beginning of the month found us cruising about that very county, with fly-rods actually in our hands. The idea was that we should acquire at once a local reputation as decent fishermen, and some knowledge of the countryside, with a view to further and more deliberate operations in the event of an unprofitable week. There was another idea which Raffles kept to himself until he had got me down there. Then one day he produced a cricket-ball in a meadow we were crossing, and threw me catches for an hour together. More hours he spent in bowling to me on the nearest green, and, if I was never a cricketer, at least I came nearer to being one by the end of that week than ever before or since. Incident began early on the Monday. We had sallied forth from a desolate little junction within quite a few miles of Milchester, had been caught in a shower, had run for shelter to a wayside inn. A florid, overdressed man was drinking in the parlour, and I could have sworn it was at the sight of him that Raffles recoiled on the threshold, and afterwards insisted on returning to the station through the rain. He assured me, however, that the odour of stale ale had almost knocked him down, and I had to make what I could of his speculative, downcast eyes and knitted brow. Milchester Abbey is a grey, quadrangle pile, deep-set in rich, woody country, and twinkling with triple rows of quaint windows, every one of which seemed alight as we drove up just in time to dress for dinner. The carriage had whirled us under I know not how many triumphal arches in process of construction, and past the tents and flagpoles of a juicy-looking cricket-field, on which Raffles undertook to bowl up to his reputation. But the chief signs of festival were within, where we found an enormous house-party assembled, including more persons of pomp, majesty, and dominion than I had ever encountered in one room before. I confess I felt overpowered. Our errand and my own presences combined to rob me of an address upon which I have sometimes plumed myself, and I have a grim recollection of my nervous relief when dinner was at last announced. I little knew what an ordeal it was to prove. I had taken in a much less formidable young lady than might have fallen to my lot. Indeed, I began by blessing my good fortune in this respect. Miss Melouche was merely the rector's daughter, and she had only been asked to make an even number. She informed me of both facts before the soup reached us, and her subsequent conversation was characterized by the same engaging candor. It exposed what was little short of a mania for imparting information. I had simply to listen, to nod, and to be thankful. When I confessed to knowing very few of those present, even by sight, my entertaining companion proceeded to tell me who everybody was, beginning on my left and working conscientiously round to her right. This lasted quite a long time, and really interested me. But a great deal that followed did not, and obviously to recapture my unworthy attention, Miss Melouche suddenly asked me, in a sensational whisper, whether I could keep a secret. I said I thought I might, whereupon another question followed, in still lower and more thrilling accents. "Are you afraid of burglars?" Burglars. I was roused at last. The word stabbed me. I repeated it in horrified query. "So I've found something to interest you at last," said Miss Melouche in naive triumph. "Yes, burglars. But don't speak so loud. It's supposed to be kept a great secret. I really oughtn't to tell you at all." "But what is there to tell?" I whispered with satisfactory impatience. "You promise not to speak of it." "Of course." "Well, then, there are burglars in the neighbourhood. Have they committed any robberies?" "Not yet." "Then how do you know?" "They've been seen in the district. Two well-known London thieves." "Two." I looked at Raffles. I had done so often during the evening, envying him his high spirits, his iron nerve, his buoyant wit, his perfect ease and self-possession. But now I pitied him. Through all my own terror and consternation, I pitied him as he sat eating and drinking, and laughing and talking, without a cloud of fear or of embarrassment on his handsome, taking, dare-devil face. I caught up my champagne and emptied the glass. "Who has seen them?" I then asked calmly.
"A detective. They were traced down from town a few days ago. They are believed to have designs on the Abbey."
"But why aren't they run in?"
"Exactly what I asked Papa on the way here this evening. He says there is no warrant out against the men at present, and all that can be done is to watch their movements."
"Oh, so they are being watched?"
"Yes, by a detective who is down here on purpose. And I heard Lord Amersteth tell Papa that they have been seen this afternoon at Warbeck Junction."
The very place where Raffles and I had been caught in the rain. Our stampede from the inn was now explained. On the other hand, I was no longer to be taken by surprise by anything that my companion might have to tell me, and I succeeded in looking her in the face with a smile.
"This is really quite exciting, Miss Melouche," said I. "May I ask how you come to know so much about it?"
"It's Papa," was the confidential reply. "Lord Amersteth consulted him, and he consulted me. But for goodness' sake, don't let it get about. I can't think what tempted me to tell you."
"You may trust me, Miss Melouche. But aren't you frightened?" Miss Melouche giggled.
"Not a bit. They won't come to the rectory. There's nothing for them there. But look round the table. Look at the diamonds. Look at old Lady Melrose's necklace alone."
The Dowager Marchioness of Melrose was one of the few persons whom it had been unnecessary to point out to me. She sat on Lord Amersteth's right, flourishing her ear-trumpet and drinking champagne with her usual notorious freedom, as dissipated and kindly a dame as the world has ever seen. It was a necklace of diamonds and sapphires that rose and fell about her ample neck.
"They say it's worth 5,000 pounds at least," continued my companion. "Lady Margaret told me so this morning. That's Lady Margaret next to your Mr. Raffles, you know. And the old dear will wear them every night. Think what a haul they would be. No, we don't feel in immediate danger at the rectory."
When the ladies rose, Miss Melouche bound me to fresh vows of secrecy and left me, I should think, with some remorse for her indiscretion, but more satisfaction at the importance which it had undoubtedly given her in my eyes. The opinion may smack of vanity, though in reality the very springs of conversation reside in that same human, universal itch to thrill the auditor. The peculiarity of Miss Melouche was that she must be thrilling at all costs, and thrilling she had surely been. I spare you my feelings of the next 2 hours. I tried hard to get a word with Raffles, but again and again I failed. In the dining-room, he and Crowley lit their cigarettes with the same match, and had their heads together all the time. In the drawing-room, I had the mortification of hearing him talk interminable nonsense into the ear-trumpet of Lady Melrose, whom he knew in town. Lastly, in the billiard-room, they had a very great and lengthy pool, while I sat aloof and chafed more than ever in the company of a very serious Scotchman, who had arrived since dinner, and who would talk of nothing but the recent improvements in instantaneous photography. He had not come to play in the matches, he told me, but to obtain for Lord Amersteth such a series of cricket photographs as had never been taken before. Whether as an amateur or a professional photographer, I was unable to determine. I remember, however, seeking distraction in little bursts of resolute attention to the conversation of this bore. And so at last the long ordeal ended. Glasses were emptied, men said good night, and I followed Raffles to his room.
"It's all up," I gasped, as he turned up the gas, and I shut the door. "We're being watched. We've been followed down from town. There's a detective here on the spot."
"How do you know?"
asked Raffles, turning upon me quite sharply, but without the least dismay. And I told him how I knew.
"Of course," I added, "it was the fellow we saw in the inn this afternoon."
"The detective," said Raffles. "Do you mean to say you don't know a detective when you see one, Bunny?"
"If that wasn't the fellow, which is?"
Raffles shook his head.
"To think that you've been talking to him for the last hour in the billiard-room and couldn't spot what he was."
"The Scotch photographer."
I paused aghast.
"Scotch he is," said Raffles, "and photographer he may be. He is also Inspector Mackenzie of Scotland Yard, the very man I sent the message to that night last April. And you couldn't spot who he was for a whole hour. Oh, Bunny, Bunny, you were never built for crime."
"But," said I, "if that was Mackenzie, who was the fellow you bolted from at Warbeck?"
"The man he's watching."
"But he's watching us." Raffles looked at me with a pitying eye, and shook his head again before handing me his open cigarette case.
"I don't know whether smoking's forbidden in one's bedroom, but you'd better take one of these and stand tight, Bunny, because I'm going to say something offensive."
I helped myself with a little laugh. "Say what you like, my dear fellow, if it really isn't you and I that Mackenzie's after."
"Well, then, it isn't, and it couldn't be. And nobody but a born Bunny would suppose for a moment that it was. Do you seriously think he would sit there and knowingly watch his man playing pool under his nose? Well, he might. He's a cool hand, Mackenzie, but I'm not cool enough to win a pool under such conditions. At least, I don't think I am. It would be interesting to see." The situation wasn't free from strain as it was, though I knew he wasn't thinking of us. Crowley told me all about it after dinner, you see. And then I'd seen one of the men for myself this afternoon. You thought it was a detective who made me turn tail at that inn. I really don't know why I didn't tell you at the time, but it was just the opposite. That loud, red-faced brute is one of the cleverest thieves in London. And I once had a drink with him and our mutual fence. I was an East Ender from tongue to toe at the moment, but you will understand that I don't run unnecessary risks of recognition by a brute like that."
"He's not alone, I hear."
"By no means. There's at least one other man with him, and it's suggested that there may be an accomplice here in the house."
"Did Lord Crowley tell you so?"
"Crowley and the champagne between them. In confidence, of course, just as your girl told you. But even in confidence he never let on about Mackenzie. He told me there was a detective in the background, but that was all. Putting him up as a guest is evidently their big secret, to be kept from the other guests because it might offend them, but more particularly from the servants, whom he's here to watch. That's my reading of the situation, Bunny, and you'll agree with me that it's infinitely more interesting than we could have imagined it would prove."
"But infinitely more difficult for us," said I with a sigh of pusillanimous relief. "Our hands are tied for this week, at all events."
"Not necessarily, my dear Bunny, though I admit that the chances are against us. Yet I'm not so sure of that either. There are all sorts of possibilities in these three-cornered combinations. Set A to watch B, and he won't have an eye left for C. That's the obvious theory, but then Mackenzie's a very big A. I should be sorry to have any boodle about me with that man in the house." "Yet it would be great to nip in between A and B and score off them both at once. It would be worth a risk, Bunny, to do that. It would be worth risking something merely to take on old hands like B and his men at their own old game. Eh, Bunny? That would be something like a match. Gentlemen and players at single wicket, by Jove!"
His eyes were brighter than I had known them for many a day. They shone with the perverted enthusiasm which was roused in him only by the contemplation of some new audacity. He kicked off his shoes and began pacing his room with noiseless rapidity. Not since the night of the old Bohemian dinner to Reuben Rosenthal had Raffles exhibited such excitement in my presence, and I was not sorry at the moment to be reminded of the fiasco to which that banquet had been the prelude. "My dear A.J.," said I, in his very own tone, "you're far too fond of the uphill game. You will eventually fall a victim to the sporting spirit and nothing else. Take a lesson from our last escape, and fly lower as you value our skins. Study the house as much as you like, but do not go and shove your head into Mackenzie's mouth." My wealth of metaphor brought him to a standstill, with his cigarette between his fingers and a grin beneath his shining eyes.
"You are quite right, Bunny. I won't. I really won't. Yet you saw old Lady Melrose's necklace. I've been wanting it for years. But I'm not going to play the fool. Honor bright, I'm not. Yet, by Jove, to get to windward of the professors and Mackenzie, too. It would be a great game, Bunny. It would be a great game.
Well, you mustn't play it this week.
No, no, I won't. But I wonder how the professors think of going to work. That's what one wants to know. I wonder if they've really got an accomplice in the house. How I wish I knew their game. But it's all right, Bunny. Don't you be jealous. It shall be as you wish.
And with that assurance I went off to my own room, and so to bed with an incredibly light heart. I had still enough of the honest man in me to welcome the postponement of our actual felonies, to dread their performance, to deplore their necessity, which is merely another way of stating the too patent fact that I was an incomparably weaker man than Raffles, while every whit as wicked. I had, however, one rather strong point. I possessed the gift of dismissing unpleasant considerations, not intimately connected with the passing moment, entirely from my mind. Through the exercise of this faculty, I had lately been living my frivolous life in town with as much ignoble enjoyment as I had derived from it the year before, and similarly, here at Milchester, in the long-dreaded cricket week, I had, after all, a quite excellent time. It is true that there were other factors in this pleasing disappointment. In the first place, mirabile dictu, there were one or two even greater duffers than I on the Abbey cricket field. Indeed, quite early in the week, when it was of most value to me, I gained considerable kudos for a lucky catch. A ball, of which I had merely heard the hum, stuck fast in my hand, which Lord Amersteth himself grasped in public congratulation. This happy accident was not to be undone even by me, and as nothing succeeds like success, and the constant encouragement of the one great cricketer on the field was in itself an immense stimulus, I actually made a run or two in my very next innings. Miss Melouche said pretty things to me that night at the great ball in honour of Viscount Crowley's majority. She also told me that was the night on which the robbers would assuredly make their raid, and was full of arch tremors when we sat out in the garden, though the entire premises were illuminated all night. Meanwhile, the quiet Scotchman took countless photographs by day, which he developed by night in a dark room admirably situated in the servants' part of the house, and it is my firm belief that only two of his fellow guests knew Mr. Clefane of Dundee for Inspector Mackenzie of Scotland Yard. The week was to end with a trumpery match on the Saturday, which two or three of us intended abandoning early in order to return to town that night. The match, however, was never played. In the small hours of the Saturday morning a tragedy took place at Milchester Abbey. Let me tell of the thing as I saw and heard it. My room opened upon the central gallery, and was not even on the same floor as that on which Raffles, and I think all the other men, were quartered. I had been put, in fact, into the dressing-room of one of the grand suites, and my two near neighbours were old Lady Melrose and my host and hostess. Now, by the Friday evening the actual festivities were at an end, and for the first time that week I must have been sound asleep since midnight, when all at once I found myself sitting up breathless. A heavy thud had come against my door, and now I heard hard breathing and the dull stamp of muffled feet.
"I've got ye," muttered a voice. "It's no use strugglin'."
It was the Scotch detective, and a new fear turned me cold. There was no reply, but the hard breathing grew harder still, and the muffled feet beat the floor to a quicker measure. In sudden panic I sprang out of bed and flung open my door. A light burnt low on the landing, and by it I could see Mackenzie swaying and staggering in a silent tussle with some powerful adversary.
"Hold this man!" he cried as I appeared. "Hold the rascal!"
But I stood like a fool until the pair of them backed into me, when with a deep breath I flung myself on the fellow whose face I had seen at last. He was one of the footmen who waited at table, and no sooner had I pinned him than the detective loosed his hold.
"Hang on to him!" he cried. "There's more of 'em below!"
And he went leaping down the stairs, as other doors opened and Lord Amersteth and his son appeared simultaneously in their pyjamas. At that my man ceased struggling, but I was still holding him when Crowley turned up the gas.
"What the devil's all this?" asked Lord Amersteth, blinking.
"'Who was that ran downstairs?'
"'MacLephane,' said I hastily.
"'Aha!' said he, turning to the footman. "'So you're the scoundrel, are you? Well done, well done. Where was he caught?'
I had no idea.
"'Here's Lady Melrose's door open,' said Crowley. "'Lady Melrose? Lady Melrose!'
"'You forget she's deaf,' said Lord Amersteth. "'Ah, that'll be her maid.'
An inner door had opened. Next instant there was a little shriek, and a white figure gesticulated on the threshold.
"'Où donc est le crâne de Madame le Marquis? La fenêtre est ouverte. Il a disparu!'
"'Window open and jewel case gone, by Jove!' exclaimed Lord Amersteth. "'Mais comment est Madame le Marquis? Est-elle bien?'
"'Oui, milord, elle dort.'
"'Sleeps through it all,' said my lord. "'She's the only one, then.'
"'What made Mackenzie... Clephane bolt?' young Crowley asked me.
"'Said there were more of them below.
"'Why the devil couldn't you tell us so before?' he cried, and went leaping downstairs in his turn.
He was followed by nearly all the cricketers, who now burst upon the scene in a body, only to desert it for the chase. Raffles was one of them, and I would gladly have been another, had not the footman chosen this moment to hurl me from him, and to make a dash in the direction from which they had come. Lord Amersteth had him in an instant, but the fellow fought desperately, and it took the two of us to drag him downstairs amid a terrified chorus from half-open doors. Eventually we handed him over to two other footmen who appeared with their nightshirts tucked into their trousers, and my host was good enough to compliment me as he led the way outside.
"'I thought I heard a shot,' he added. "'Didn't you?'
"'I thought I heard three.' And out we dashed into the darkness. I remember how the gravel pricked my feet, how the wet grass numbed them as we made for the sound of voices on an outlying lawn. So dark was the night that we were in the cricketers' midst before we saw the shimmer of their pyjamas. And then Lord Amersteth almost trod on Mackenzie as he lay prostrate in the dew.
"'Who's this?' he cried. "'What on earth's happened?'
"'It's Clephane,' said a man who knelt over him. "'He's got a bullet in him somewhere.'
"'Is he alive?'
"'Barely.'
"'Good God! Where's Crowley?'
"'Here I am,' called a breathless voice. "'It's no good, you fellows. There's nothing to show which way they've gone.' "'Here's Raffles. He's chucked it, too!'
And they ran up panting.
"'Well, we've got one of them, at all events,' muttered Lord Amersteth. "'The next thing is to get this poor fellow indoors. Take his shoulders, somebody. Now his middle. Join hands under him. All together now. That's the way. Poor fellow. Poor fellow. His name isn't Clephane at all. He's a Scotland Yard detective down here for these very villains.'
Raffles was the first to express surprise. But he had also been the first to raise the wounded man, nor had any of them a stronger or more tender hand in the slow procession to the house. In a little we had the senseless man stretched on a sofa in the library, and there, with ice on his wound and brandy in his throat, his eyes opened and his lips moved. Lord Amersteth bent down to catch the words.
"'Yes, yes,' said he. "'We've got one of them safe and sound. The brute you collared upstairs.'
Lord Amersteth bent lower.
"'By Jove! Lowered the jewel case out of the window, did he? And they've got clean away with it. Well, well. I only hope we'll be able to pull this good fellow through. He's off again.'
An hour passed. The sun was rising. It found a dozen young fellows on the settees in the billiard-room, drinking whiskey and soda-water in their overcoats and pyjamas, and still talking excitedly in one breath. A timetable was being passed from hand to hand. The doctor was still in the library. At last the door opened, and Lord Amersteth put in his head.
"'It isn't hopeless,' said he, "'but it's bad enough. There'll be no cricket today.'
Another hour, and most of us were on our way to catch the early train. Between us we filled a compartment almost to suffocation. And still we talked altogether of the night's event. And still I was a little hero in my way, for having kept hold of the one ruffian who had been taken. And my gratification was subtle and intense. Raffles watched me under lowered lids,
Not a word had we had together. Not a word did we have until we had left the others at Paddington, and were skimming through the streets in a hansom with noiseless tires and a tinkling bell.
"Well, Bunny," said Raffles, "so the professors have it, eh?"
"Yes," said I, "and I'm jolly glad."
"That poor Mackenzie has a ball in his chest?"
"That you and I have been on the decent side for once." He shrugged his shoulders.
"You're hopeless, Bunny, quite hopeless. I take it you wouldn't have refused your share if the boodle had fallen to us. Yet you positively enjoy coming off second best, for the second time running. I confess, however, that the professor's methods were full of interest to me. I, for one, have probably gained as much in experience as I have lost in other things. That lowering the jewel-case out of the window was a very simple and effective expedient. Two of them had been waiting below for it for hours."
"How do you know?" I asked.
"I saw them from my own window, which was just above the dear old lady's. I was fretting for that necklace in particular when I went up to turn in for our last night, and I happened to look out of my window. In point of fact, I wanted to see whether the one below was open, and whether there was the slightest chance of working the oracle with my sheet for a rope. Of course I took the precaution of turning my light off first, and it was a lucky thing I did. I saw the pros right down below, and they never saw me. I saw a little tiny luminous disk for just an instant, and then again for an instant a few minutes later. Of course I knew what it was, for I have my own watch-dial daubed with luminous paint. It makes a lantern of sorts when you can get no better, but these fellows were not using theirs as a lantern. They were under the old lady's window. They were watching the time. The whole thing was arranged with their accomplice inside. Set a thief to catch a thief. In a minute I had guessed what the whole thing proved to be."
"And you did nothing?" I exclaimed.
"On the contrary, I went downstairs and straight into Lady Melrose's room."
"You did?"
"Without a moment's hesitation. To save her jewels. And I was prepared to yell as much into her ear-trumpet for all the house to hear. But the dear lady is too deaf and too fond of her dinner to wake easily."
"Well?"
"She didn't stir."
"And yet you allowed the professors, as you call them, to take her jewels, case and all?"
"All but this," said Raffles, thrusting his fist into my lap. "I would have shown it to you before, but really, old fellow, your face all day has been worth a fortune to the firm."
And he opened his fist, to shut it next instant on the bunch of diamonds and of sapphires that I had last seen encircling the neck of Lady Melrose. End of Gentlemen and Players.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. Le Premier Pas. That night he told me the story of his earliest crime. Not since the fateful morning of the Ides of March, when he had just mentioned it as an unreported incident of a certain cricket tour, had I succeeded in getting a word out of Raffles on the subject. It was not for want of trying. He would shake his head and watch his cigarette smoke thoughtfully. A subtle look in his eyes, half cynical, half wistful, as though the decent, honest days that were no more had had their merits after all. Raffles would plan a fresh enormity, or glory in the last, with the unmitigated enthusiasm of the artist. It was impossible to imagine one throb or twitter of compunction beneath those frankly egotistic and infectious transports. And yet, the ghost of a dead remorse seemed still to visit him with the memory of his first felony, so that I had given the story up long before the night of our return from Milchester. Cricket, however, was in the air, and Raffles' cricket-bag back where he sometimes kept it, in the fender, with the remains of an Oriental label still adhering to the leather.
My eyes had been on this label for some time, and I suppose his eyes had been on mine, for all at once he asked me if I still burned to hear that yarn. "It's no use," I replied. "You won't spin it. I must imagine it for myself."
"How can you?"
"Oh, I begin to know your methods."
"You take it I went in with my eyes open, as I do now, eh?"
"I can't imagine you're doing otherwise."
"My dear Bunny, it was the most unpremeditated thing I ever did in my life."
His chair wheeled back into the books as he sprang up with sudden energy. There was quite an indignant glitter in his eyes. "I can't believe that," said I craftily. "I can't pay you such a poor compliment."
"Then you must be a fool,"
he broke off, stared hard at me, and in a trice stood smiling in his own despite.
"Or a better knave than I thought you, Bunny, and by Jove, it's the knave. Well, I suppose I'm fairly drawn. I'll give you best, as they say out there. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking of the thing myself. Last night's racket reminds me of it in one or two respects. I'll tell you what, though. This is an occasion in any case, and I'm going to celebrate it by breaking the one good rule of my life. I'm going to have a second drink."
The whiskey tinkled, the siphon fizzled, the ice plopped home, and seated there in his pajamas with the inevitable cigarette, Raffles told me the story that I had given up hoping to hear. The windows were wide open. The sounds of Piccadilly floated in at first. Long before he finished, the last wheels had rattled, the last brawler was removed. We alone broke the quiet of the summer night.
"No, they do you very well indeed. You pay for nothing but drinks, so to speak, but I'm afraid mine were of a comprehensive character. I had started in a hole. I ought really to have refused the invitation. Then we all went to the Melbourne Cup, and I had the certain winner that didn't win. And that's not the only way you can play the fool in Melbourne. I wasn't the steady old stager I am now, Bunny. My analysis was a confession in itself. But the others didn't know how hard up I was, and I swore they shouldn't. I tried the Jews, but they're extra fly out there. Then I thought of a kinsman of sorts, a second cousin of my father's whom none of us knew anything about, except that he was supposed to be in one or other of the colonies. If he was a rich man, well and good, I would work him. If not, there would be no harm done. I tried to get on his tracks, and as luck would have it, I succeeded, or thought I had, at the very moment when I happened to have a few days to myself. I was cut over on the hand, just before the big Christmas match, and couldn't have bowled a ball if they had played me. The surgeon who fixed me up happened to ask if I was any relation of Raffles of the National Bank, and the pure luck of it almost took my breath away. A relation who was a high official in one of the banks, who would finance me on my mere name. Could anything be better? I made up my mind that this Raffles was the man I wanted, and was awfully sold to find the next moment that he wasn't a high official at all. Nor had the doctor so much as met him, but had merely read of him in connection with a small sensation at the suburban branch which my namesake managed. An armed robber had been rather pluckily beaten off, with a bullet in him, by this Raffles, and the sort of thing was so common out there that this was the first I had heard of it. A suburban branch! My financier had faded into some excellent fellow with a billet to lose if he called his soul his own. Still, a manager was a manager, and I said I would soon see whether this was the relative I was looking for, if he would be good enough to give me the name of that branch.
"I'll do more," says the doctor. "I'll get you the name of the branch he's been promoted to, for I think I heard they moved him up one already."
And the next day he brought me the name of the township of Yea, some 50 miles north of Melbourne. But, with the vagueness which characterized all his information, he was unable to say whether I should find my relative there or not.
"He's a single man, and his initials are W.F.,"
said the doctor, who was certain enough of the immaterial points.
"He left his old post several days ago, but it appears he's not due at the new one till the new year. No doubt he'll go before then to take things over and settle in. You might find him up there, and you might not.
If I were you, I should write." "That'll lose 2 days," said I, "and more if he isn't there," for I'd grown quite keen on this up-country manager, and I felt that if I could get at him while the holidays were still on, a little conviviality might help matters considerably.
"Then," said the doctor, "I should get a quiet horse and ride. You needn't use that hand."
"Can't I go by train?"
"You can and you can't. You would still have to ride. I suppose you're a horseman?"
"Yes."
"Then I should certainly ride all the way. It's a delightful road, through Whittlesea and over the Plenty Ranges. It'll give you some idea of the bush, Mr. Raffles, and you'll see the sources of the water supply of this city, sir. You'll see where every drop of it comes from. The pure Yan Yean. I wish I had the time to ride with you."
"But where can I get a horse?" The doctor thought a moment.
"I have a mare of my own that's as fat as butter for want of work," said he. "It would be a charity to me to sit on her back for 100 miles or so, and then I should know you'd have no temptation to use that hand."
"You're far too good," I protested.
"You're A.J. Raffles," he said.
And if ever there was a prettier compliment or a finer insistence of even colonial hospitality, I can only say, Bunny, that I never heard of either.
He sipped his whiskey, threw away the stump of his cigarette, and lit another before continuing.
"Well, I managed to write a line to W.F. with my own hand, which, as you will gather, was not very badly wounded. It was simply this third finger that was split and in splints. The next morning the doctor packed me off on a bovine beast that would have done for an ambulance. Half the team came up to see me start. The rest were rather sick with me for not stopping to see the match out, as if I could help them to win by watching them. They little knew the game I got on myself, but still less did I know the game I was going to play. It was an interesting ride enough, especially after passing the place called Whittlesea, a real wild township on the lower slope of the ranges, where I recollect having a deadly meal of hot mutton and tea, with the thermometer at 3 figures in the shade. The first 30 miles or so was a good metal road, too good to go half round the world to ride on, but after Whittlesea it was a mere track over the ranges, a track I often couldn't see and left entirely to the mare. Now it dipped into a gully and ran through a creek, and all the time the local colour was inches thick, gum-trees galore and parrots all colours of the rainbow. In one place a whole forest of gums had been ring-barked, and were just as though they had been painted white, without a leaf or a living thing for miles. And the first living thing I did meet was the sort to give you the creeps. It was a riderless horse coming full tilt through the bush, with the saddle twisted round and the stirrup-irons ringing. Without thinking, I had a shot at heading him with the doctor's mare, and blocked him just enough to allow a man who came galloping after to do the rest. "Thank ye, mister," growled the man, a huge chap in a red-checked shirt, with a beard like W. G. Grace, but the very devil of an expression.
"Been an accident?" said I, reining up.
"Yes," said he, scowling as though he defied me to ask any more. "And a nasty one," I said, "if that's blood on the saddle." "Well, Bunny, I may be a blackguard myself, but I don't think I ever looked at a fellow as that chap looked at me. But I stared him out, and forced him to admit that it was blood on the twisted saddle, and after that he became quite tame. He told me exactly what had happened. A mate of his had been dragged under a branch, and had his nose smashed, but that was all. Had sat tight after it till he dropped from loss of blood. Another mate was with him back in the bush. As I've said already, Bunny, I wasn't the old stager that I am now, in any respect, and we parted good enough friends. He asked me which way I was going, and when I told him, he said I should save 7 miles and get a good hour earlier to Yea by striking off the track and making for a peak that we could see through the trees, and following a creek that I should see from the peak. Don't smile, Bunny. I began by saying I was a child in those days. Of course, the short cut was the long way round, and it was nearly dark when that unlucky mare and I saw the single street of Yea.
I was looking for the bank when a fellow in a white suit ran down from the veranda.
"Mr. Raffles,"
said he. "Mr. Raffles," said I, laughing as I shook his hand.
"You're late."
"I was misdirected."
"That all?"
"I'm relieved," he said. "Do you know what they are saying? There are some brand-new bushrangers on the road between Whittlesea and this, a second Kelly gang. They'd have caught a Tartar in you, eh?"
"They would in you," I retorted, and my two cokes shut him up and seemed to puzzle him. Yet there was much more sense in it than in his compliment to me, which was absolutely pointless.
"I'm afraid you'll find things pretty rough," he resumed when he had unstrapped my valise and handed my reins to his man. "It's lucky you're a bachelor like myself." I could not quite see the point of this remark either, since, had I been married, I should hardly have sprung my wife upon him in this free-and-easy fashion. I muttered the conventional sort of thing, and then he said I should find it all right when I had settled, as though I had come to graze upon him for weeks.
"Well," thought I, "these colonials do take the cake for hospitality." And still marveling, I let him lead me into the private part of the bank.
"Dinner will be ready in a quarter of an hour," said he as we entered. "I thought you might like a tub first. You'll find all ready in the room at the end of the passage. Sing out if there's anything you want. Your luggage hasn't turned up yet, by the way, but here's a letter that came this morning."
"Not for me?"
"Yes, didn't you expect one?"
"I certainly did not."
"Well, here it is."
And as he lit me to my room, I read my own superscription of the previous day, to W. F. Raffles.
"Bunny, you've had your wind bagged at footer, I dare say. You know what that's like. All I can say is that my moral wind was bagged by that letter, as I hope, old chap, I have never yet bagged yours. I couldn't speak. I could only stand with my letter in my hands until he had the good taste to leave me by myself. W. F. Raffles. We had mistaken each other for W. F. Raffles, for the new manager who had not yet arrived. Small wonder we had conversed at cross purposes. The only wonder was that we had not discovered our mutual mistake. How the other man would have laughed! But I could not laugh. By Jove, no, it was no laughing matter for me. I saw the whole thing in a flash, without a tremor, but with the direst depression from my own single point of view. Call it callous if you like, Bunny, but remember that I was in much the same hole as you've since been in yourself, and that I had counted on this W. F. Raffles even as you had counted on A. J. I thought of the man with the W. G. beard, the riderless horse and the bloody saddle, the deliberate misdirection that had put me off the track and out of the way, and now the missing manager and the report of bushrangers at this end. But I simply don't pretend to have felt any personal pity for a man whom I had never seen. That kind of pity's usually cant. And besides, all mine was needed for myself. I was in as big a hole as ever. What the devil was I to do? I doubt if I have sufficiently impressed upon you the absolute necessity of my returning to Melbourne in funds. As a matter of fact, it was less the necessity than my own determination, which I can truthfully ascribe as absolute. Money I would have, but how? But how? Would this stranger be open to persuasion if I told him the truth? No, that would set us all scouring the country for the rest of the night. Why should I tell him? Suppose I left him to find out his mistake. Would anything be gained? Bunny, I give you my word that I went into dinner without a definite intention in my head, or one premeditated lie upon my lips. I might do the decent, natural thing, and explain matters without loss of time. On the other hand, there was no hurry. I had not opened the letter, and could always pretend I had not noticed the initials. Meanwhile, something might turn up. I could wait a little and see. Tempted I already was, but as yet the temptation was vague, and its very vagueness made me tremble.
"Bad news, I'm afraid?"
said the manager when at last I sat down at his table.
"A mere annoyance,"
I answered.
I do assure you, on the spur of the moment and nothing else. But my lie was told, my position was taken. From that moment onward there was no retreat. By implication, without realizing what I was doing, I had already declared myself W. F. Raffles. Therefore W. F. Raffles I would be, in that bank for that night. And the devil teach me how to use my lie.
Again he raised his glass to his lips. I had forgotten mine. His cigarette case caught the gaslight as he handed it to me. I shook my head without taking my eyes from his.
"The devil played up,"
continued Raffles with a laugh.
"Before I tasted my soup I had decided what to do. I had determined to rob that bank instead of going to bed, and to be back in Melbourne for breakfast if the doctor's mare could do it. I would tell the old fellow that I had missed my way and been bushed for hours, as I easily might have been, and had never got to Yea at all. At Yea, on the other hand, the personation and robbery would ever after be attributed to a member of the gang that had waylaid and murdered the new manager with that very object. You are acquiring some experience in such matters, Bunny. I ask you, was there ever a better get-out? Last night's was something like it, only never such a certainty. And I saw it from the beginning, saw to the end before I had finished my soup. To increase my chances, the cashier, who also lived in the bank, was away over the holidays, had actually gone down to Melbourne to see us play, and the man who had taken my horse also waited at table, for he and his wife were the only servants, and they slept in a separate building. You may depend I ascertained this before we had finished dinner. Indeed, I was by way of asking too many questions. The most oblique and delicate was that which elicited my host's name, Ewbank. Nor was I careful enough to conceal their drift. "Do you know," said this fellow Ewbank, who was one of the downright sort, "if it wasn't you, I should say you were in a funk of robbers. Have you lost your nerve?" "I hope not," said I, turning jolly hot, I can tell you. "But, well, it's not a pleasant thing to have to put a bullet through a fellow."
"No," said he coolly. "I should enjoy nothing better myself. Besides, yours didn't go through."
"I wish it had," I was smart enough to cry. "Amen," said he, and I emptied my glass. Actually, I did not know whether my wounded bank robber was in prison, dead, or at large. But now that I had had more than enough of it, Ewbank would come back to the subject. He admitted that the staff was small, but as for himself, he had a loaded revolver under his pillow all night, under the counter all day, and he was only waiting for his chance.
"Under the counter, eh?" I was ass enough to say. "Yes, so had you."
He was looking at me in surprise, and something told me that to say, "Of course, I had forgotten," would have been quite fatal, considering what I was supposed to have done. So I looked down my nose and shook my head.
"But the papers said you had," he cried.
"Not under the counter," said I.
"But it's the regulation."
For the moment, Bunny, I felt stumped, though I trust I only looked more superior than before, and I think I justified my look.
"The regulation," I said at length,
in the most offensive tone at my command. "Yes, the regulation would have us all dead men. My dear sir, do you expect your bank robber to let you reach for your gun in the place where he knows it's kept? I had mine in my pocket, and I got my chance by retreating from the counter with all visible reluctance." Ewbank stared at me with open eyes and a five-barred forehead. Then down came his fist on the table.
"By God, that was smart! Still," he added, like a man who would not be in the wrong,
"the papers said the other thing, you know."
"Of course," I rejoined, "because they said what I told them. You wouldn't have me advertise the fact that I improved upon the bank's regulations, would you?"
So that cloud rolled over, and by Jove, it was a cloud with a golden lining. Not silver, real good Australian gold. For old Ewbank hadn't quite appreciated me till then. He was a hard nut, a much older man than myself, and I felt pretty sure he thought me young for the place,
and my supposed feat a fluke. But I never saw a man change his mind more openly. He got out his best brandy, he made me throw away the cigar I was smoking, and opened a fresh box. He was a convivial-looking party, with a red mustache, and a very humorous face, not unlike Tom Emmett's. And from that moment I laid myself out to attack him on his convivial flank. But he wasn't a Rosenthal, Bunny. He had a treble-seamed, hand-sewn head, and could have drunk me under the table 10 times over. "All right," I thought. "You may go to bed sober, but you'll sleep like a timber yard." And I threw half he gave me through the open window when he wasn't looking. But he was a good chap, Eubank, and don't you imagine he was at all intemperate. Convivial, I called him, and I only wish he had been something more. He did, however, become more and more genial as the evening advanced, and I had not much difficulty in getting him to show me round the bank at what was really an unearthly hour for such a proceeding. It was when he went to fetch the revolver before turning in. I kept him out of his bed another 20 minutes, and I knew every inch of the business premises before I shook hands with Eubank in my room. You won't guess what I did with myself for the next hour. I undressed and went to bed. The incessant strain involved in even the most deliberate impersonation is the most wearing thing I know. Then how much more so when the impersonation is impromptu? There's no getting your eye in. The next word may bowl you out. It's batting in a bad light all through. I haven't told you of half the tight places I was in during a conversation that ran into hours and became dangerously intimate towards the end. You can imagine them for yourself. And then picture me spread out on my bed, getting my second wind for the big deed of the night. Once more I was in luck, for I had not been lying there long before I heard my dear Eubank snoring like a harmonium, and the music never ceased for a moment. It was as loud as ever when I crept out and closed my door behind me, as regular as ever when I stopped to listen at his. And I have still to hear the concert that I shall enjoy much more. The good fellow snored me out of the bank, and was still snoring when I again stood and listened under his open window. Why did I leave the bank first? To catch and saddle the mare, and tether her in a clump of trees close by. To have the means of escape nice and handy before I went to work. I have often wondered at the instinctive wisdom of the precaution. Unconsciously I was acting on what has been one of my guiding principles ever since. Pains and patience were required. I had to get my saddle without waking the man, and I was not used to catching horses in a horse paddock. Then I distrusted the poor mare, and I went back to the stables for a hat full of oats, which I left with her in the clump, hat and all. There was a dog, too, to reckon with. Our very worst enemy, Bunny. But I had been acute enough to make immense friends with him during the evening, and he wagged his tail, not only when I came downstairs, but when I reappeared at the back door. As the soi-disant new manager, I had been able, in the most ordinary course, to pump poor Eubank about anything and everything connected with the working of the bank, especially in those 20 last invaluable minutes before turning in. And I had made a very natural point of asking him where he kept, and would recommend me to keep, the keys at night. Of course, I thought he would take them with him to his room, but no such thing. He had a Dodge worth two of that. What it was doesn't much matter, but no outsider would have found those keys in a month of Sundays. I, of course, had them in a few seconds, and in a few more I was in the strong room itself. I forgot to say that the moon had risen and was letting quite a lot of light into the bank. I had, however, brought a bit of a candle with me from my room, and in the strong room, which was down some narrow stairs behind the counter in the banking chamber, I had no hesitation in lighting it. There was no window down there, and though I could no longer hear old Eubank snoring, I had not the slightest reason to anticipate disturbance from that quarter. I did think of locking myself in while I was at work, but thank goodness the iron door had no keyhole on the inside. Well, there were heaps of gold in the safe, but I only took what I needed and could comfortably carry. Not much more than a couple of hundred altogether. Not a note would I touch, and my native caution came out also in the way I divided the sovereigns between all my pockets. and packed them up so that I shouldn't be like the old woman of Banbury Cross. Well, you think me too cautious still, but I was insanely cautious then. And so it was that just as I was ready to go, whereas I might have been gone 10 minutes, there came a violent knocking at the outer door. Bunny, it was the outer door of the banking chamber. My candle must have been seen, and there I stood with the grease running hot over my fingers, in that brick grave of a strong-room. There was only one thing to be done. I must trust to the sound sleeping of Eubank upstairs, open the door myself, knock the visitor down or shoot him with the revolver I had been new chum enough to buy before leaving Melbourne, and make a dash for that clump of trees in the doctor's mare. My mind was made up in an instant, and I was at the top of the strong-room stairs. The knocking still continued, when a second sound drove me back. It was the sound of bare feet coming along the corridor. My narrow stair was stone. I tumbled down it with little noise, and had only to push open the iron door, for I had left the keys in the safe. As I did so, I heard a handle turn overhead, and thanked my gods that I had shut every single door behind me. You see, old chap, one's caution doesn't always let one in.
"Who's that knocking?"
said Eubank up above. I could not make out the answer, but it sounded to me like the irrelevant supplication of a spent man. What I did hear plainly was the cocking of the bank revolver before the bolts were shot back. Then a tottering step, a hard, short, shallow breathing, and Eubank's voice in horror.
"My God! Good Lord, what's happened to you? You're bleeding like a pig!"
"Not now," came with a grateful sort of sigh.
"But you have been. What's done it?"
"Bush rangers.
Down the road?"
"This and Whittlesea. Tied to tree. Cockshots. Left me. Bleed to death." The weak voice failed, and the bare feet bolted. Now was my time if the poor devil had fainted, but I could not be sure. And there I crouched down below in the dark, at the half-shut iron door, not less spellbound than imprisoned. It was just as well, for Eubank wasn't gone a minute.
"Drink this,"
I heard him say, and when the other spoke again, his voice was stronger.
"Now I begin to feel alive. Don't talk. It does me good. You don't know what it was, all those miles alone. One an hour at the outside. I never thought I should come through. You must let me tell you, in case I don't."
"Well, have another sip."
"Thank you. I said bush rangers. Of course, there are no such things nowadays."
"What were they, then?"
"Bank thieves. The one that had the pot shots was the very brute I drove out of the bank at Coburg, with the bullet in him."
"I knew it!"
"Of course you did, Bunny. So did I, down in that strong room. But old Eubank didn't, and I thought he was never going to speak again. 'You're delirious,' he says at last. 'Who in blazes do you think you are?'
'The new manager.'
'The new manager's in bed and asleep upstairs.'
'When did he arrive?'
'This evening.'
'Call himself Raffles?'
'Yes.'
'Well, I'm damned,'
whispered the real man.
'I thought it was just revenge, but now I see what it was. My dear sir, the man upstairs is an impostor, if he's upstairs still. He must be one of the gang. He's going to rob the bank if he hasn't done so already.'
'If he hasn't done so already?' muttered Eubank after him. 'If he's upstairs still? By God, if he is, I'm sorry for him.' His tone was quiet enough, but about the nastiest I've ever heard. I tell you, Bunny, I was glad I'd brought that revolver. It looked as though it must be mine against his, muzzle to muzzle.
'Better have a look down here first,'
said the new manager. 'While he gets through his window? No, no, he's not down here.'
'It's easy to have a look.'
Bunny, if you ask me what was the most thrilling moment of my infamous career, I say it was that moment. There I stood at the bottom of those narrow stone stairs, inside the strong-room, with the door a good foot open, and I didn't know whether it would creak or not. The light was coming nearer, and I didn't know. I had to chance it. And it didn't creak a bit. It was far too solid and well hung, and I couldn't have banged it if I tried. It was too heavy, and it fitted so close that I felt and heard the air squeeze out in my face. Every shred of light went out, except the streak underneath, and it brightened. How I blessed that door! "No, he's not down there," I heard, as though through cotton wool. Then the streak went out too, and in a few seconds I ventured to open once more, and was in time to hear them creeping to my room. Well, now there was not a fifth of a second to be lost, but I'm proud to say I came up those stairs on my toes and fingers, and out of that bank. They'd gone and left the door open, just as gingerly as though my time had been my own. I didn't even forget to put on the hat that the doctor's mare was eating her oats out of, as well as she could with a bit, or it alone would have landed me. I didn't even gallop away, but just jogged off quietly in the thick dust at the side of the road, though I own my heart was galloping, and thanked my stars the bank was at that end of the township, in which I really hadn't set foot. The very last thing I heard was the two managers raising Cain and the coachman. And now, Bunny.
He stood up and stretched himself, with a smile that ended in a yawn. The black windows had faded through every shade of indigo. They now framed their opposite neighbors, stark and livid in the dawn, and the gas seemed turned to nothing in the globes. "But that's not all!" I cried.
"I'm sorry to say it is," said Raffles apologetically. "The thing should have ended with an exciting chase, I know, but somehow it didn't. I suppose they thought I had got no end of a start. Then they had made up their minds that I belonged to the gang, which was not so many miles away, and one of them had got as much as he could carry from that gang as it was. But I wasn't to know that, and I'm bound to say that there was plenty of excitement left for me. Lord, how I made that poor brute travel when I got among the trees! Though we must have made it over 50 miles from Melbourne, we had done it at a snail's pace. And those stolen oats had brisked the old girl up to such a pitch that she fairly bolted when she felt her nose turn south. By Jove, it was no joke, in and out among those trees and under branches with your face in the mane. I told you about the forest of dead gums. It looked perfectly ghostly in the moonlight, and I found it as still as I had left it. So still that I pulled up there, my first halt, and lay with my ear to the ground for 2 or 3 minutes. But I heard nothing, not a thing but the mare's bellow in my own heart. I'm sorry, Bunny, but if ever you write my memoirs, you won't have any difficulty in working up that chase. Play those dead gum trees for all they're worth, and let the bullets fly like hail. I'll turn round in my saddle to see Eubank coming up held to leather in his white suit, and I'll duly paint it red. Do it in the third person, then they won't know how it's going to end."
"But I don't know myself," I complained. "Did the mare carry you all the way back to Melbourne?"
"Every rod, pole, or perch. I had her well seen to at our hotel, and returned her to the doctor in the evening. He was tremendously tickled to hear that I had been bushed. Next morning he brought me the paper to show me what I had escaped at Yea."
"Without suspecting anything?"
"Ah," said Raffles as he put out the gas. "That's a point on which I've never made up my mind. The mare and her colour was a coincidence. Luckily she was only a bay, and I fancy the condition of the beast must have told a tale. The doctor's manner was certainly different. I'm inclined to think he suspected something, though not the right thing. I wasn't expecting him, and I fear my appearance may have increased his suspicions."
I asked why.
"I used to have a rather heavy moustache," said Raffles.
but I lost it the day after I lost my innocence.
End of Le Premier Pas.